The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
Hey, this is Emily.
And this is Bridget.
And you're listening to Stuff Mom Never Told You.
And today, I'm so excited to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is punk rock and Riot Grrrl. If you've listened to Kristen and Caroline tackle this topic, we're going to be doing it a little bit different. So you could think of this as really a companion piece to the really great episode they put out called Women and Punk. I have been a long-term lover of all things punk, really all things music. In college, I was actually a radio DJ at my local college radio station, WZMB, Greenville, North Carolina.
Oh my God, you've been behind the mic for a while.
Oh,
then.
I have.
No wonder you look such like such a natural for the podcast.
Yes, I was DJ Coleslaw was my handle, and that is a reference to Enid Coleslaw from the comic book Ghost World. And I DJed a radio show only punk music, so I've been a big punk fan for a long time. I've always loved Riot Grrrl. And today, I am so thrilled to talk through some of the ways that Black women have kind of sadly been erased in the history of punk music and the history of retelling the story behind what you might think of as Riot Grrrl and why that is.
Yeah, and punk rock, I think, is typically thought of as a white thing.
It is.
Right? Or at least it's predominantly, even like punk rock of the 80s and 90s, we think of a lot of British bands that come to mind, like The Clash, what is it, the Sex Pistols, and even into the sort of 90s grunge, which I know is not technically the same exact thing as punk. I'm no punk expert, but I think of a lot of angry white people.
Totally, and I think that perception does persist, and I think that's fair because punk definitely has roots in this hyper-masculine response to sort of white working-class frustration, particularly in the UK, so it's totally fair. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't a place for Black musicians, particularly Black women, in these movements. There's this great quote from Dazed Magazine. "There's no denying that the UK punk scene was in part driven by the anger and isolation felt by white working class. But punk music is not the sole property of whiteness, even though to many people of my generation it may appear that way at first glance. Like many facets of pop culture, its historical image has been whitewashed. When you think about punk's history, it's bands like The Clash, The Sex Pistols, The Ramones that immediately come to mind." And so I think it's important that even though, yes, it may have these roots in white frustrations of the working class, punk music has the same kind of roots in Black communities.
Yeah, and in so many ways, as we've talked about music and cultural appropriation in the past, O'Miley comes to mind. But what I find really interesting about punk here is that article goes on to say that in many ways, Black people were the original counterculture figures. And in so many ways, like, rock and roll has its roots in Black culture.
Completely. I mean, if you take in you know, classes on cultural anthropology and where punk and rock and roll come from, it really undeniably does have roots in Black musicians. Going back to folks like Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, these are folks who were really improvising, really trying a lot of new things, and a lot of why things like rock and roll and then later punk, why they stuck around so fervently. So for instance, there's always been this really obvious connection between punk music and, you know, musical genres like reggae. I think that you can definitely hear their influence in there. And it's just like this journalist, Charlie Birkenhurst, notes, the spirit of punk is present and always has been in music made by Black people. So really, when you're thinking of punk as this white art form, it can just as easily be said to be a Black art form as well.
Yeah. So that is interesting how, when you think of punk rock in particular, it has been whitewashed, even though the roots of punk rock came from a lot of Black artists. If you think about rock and roll writ large, there's a lot of whiteness associated with rock and roll and with its spinoff of punk rock. But in reality, a lot of that cultural appropriation started way back in the 50s. So NYU's cultural anthropologist professor Maureen Mahan explains in this book, "What Are You Doing Here? A Black Woman's Life and Liberation in Heavy Metal." She says that as more white people started to be attracted to rock and roll, Black people started to think this is for them, not for us. There were always Black people participating and present, but they had started to be outnumbered. So beyond the sheer outnumbering, white rock musicians often had more success performing songs originally recorded by Black blues, R&B, and rock musicians. I'm thinking Elvis, right? Elvis became, he was the original Miley.
Oh, he was.
Right? Like, he became controversial and he became known for the ways in which that white Southern dude was basically embracing artistry that had originally really been a Black thing.
Right. And if you've ever seen the movie Dreamgirls, which, by the way, if you haven't seen it, it's so good, they illustrate this so nicely with the idea of they have this soulful song that this Black girl group, you know, sings, and that when that song is re-recorded by white teenagers that sound very bubbly, it becomes an instant smash hit. Huh. And so I think, you know, there are so many illustrations of that throughout culture. But really, it's just like Maureen Mahone says, this idea that it becomes something that you then associate with whiteness, whether it actually has roots in whiteness alone, irregardless of that, it just becomes something that you think of as white.
Mm.
And I think as someone who has been a long, you know, lover of all kinds of music, but specifically punk, that certainly jives with my personal experience. You know, I grew up feeling very isolated, being like a Black punk fan, particularly a black female punk fan. But I grew up feeling really self-conscious for liking something that was quote unquote for white kids.
Huh.
I wouldn't say I was teased for it, but I was never very open about my, you know, love of punk. But I never felt comfortable talking about it. When I would buy CDs at the record store, I always remember feeling this kind of weird sense of shame.
Huh.
Or I would sometimes, this is so embarrassing, but I would sometimes ask, I remember I was buying a Weezer CD, and I asked, do you guys offer gift wrapping? Because I didn't want the teller to be like, oh, why is this Black girl buying a Weezer CD? So it's definitely been part of my upbringing.
Wow.
And I think from the research, you actually see a lot of Black kids who grow up feeling this way.
Huh.
There's been an entire movement started called the Afropunk movement that started as a collection of message boards online for other Black punk fans to find each other and connect and swap stories and swap zines and swap CDs. Now that whole movement has grown into an international phenomenon. They have a global festival. They have festivals in South Africa and New York, Atlanta, Brooklyn. And it's really taken off as this cultural thing. Now it started as this thing that a lot of Black kids felt kind of anxiety around, but now it's sort of the who's who of like the Black glam folks. You see lots of, you know, there was a spread in Vogue magazine of the various fashions at Afropunk, and
oh,
Solange Knowles performs there.
Right.
It's this like very hip, cool thing. But in the beginning, it definitely did not feel that way.
So would you say Afropunk is a different genre, or is it a reclaiming of a genre that had been whitewashed?
I think it's a reclaiming, and
okay,
I think it's sort of carving out space for these Black punk fans who have long felt isolated, ignored, erased, or just felt kind of weird about liking something that has been associated so heavily with whiteness. It's a reclaiming and a way of opening up space for those folks to connect and meet each other and feel good about it. So basically, what it comes down to is that Black folks aren't the people that we talk about when we talk about punk music. And we're going to talk about why that's such a big problem after this quick break.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
And we're back. So the erasure of people of color from depictions of the punk movement really came to a head pretty recently amidst criticism that the recent Riot Girl collection at NYU's Fail Library and a recent book of the same name chronicling the movement that all but erased Black women. Now, Kristen and Caroline, again, they have this great episode all about the Riot Girl movement, and they mentioned this collection, this NYU collection, in that episode.
So wait, can you back up and explain to me, because I had not really heard of the term Riot Girl before today's episode. So what is Riot Girl all about?
Yeah, so according to Race and Riot Girl from a journal out of the University of Washington's Department of Gender Studies, quote, Riot Girl is an international underground feminist movement, mainly youth-oriented, that initially emerged from the West Coast American alternative and punk music scene. You could think of that as bands like The Slits, The Raincoats, Heavens to Betsy. This was really, and Kristen and Caroline, shout out to them because they break this down so nicely. This was really a movement about young women getting to college, feeling a little bit frustrated with the lack of ability to talk about things they were dealing with, things like sexual assault, things like sexism, and expressing those frustrations through music.
And in this case, Riot Girl is spelled with a bunch of R's in there, right? So it's like a growl.
Riot Girl.
Yeah, so these are like angry young women screaming / shouting / singing their feels, which I think is a really cool artistic expression of totally understandable and righteous anger.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just to be clear, I love Riot Girl. I think a lot of what we're going to talk about in today's episode critiques and pushes back on the whiteness of the spaces that Riot Girl presented, but I really found my voice through a lot of these screaming young women, through folks like Kathleen Hanna, who's one of my idols, through bands like La Tigre. These were groups that really were seminal in my development, so I don't want it to come off like I'm trashing them, because I'm definitely not. But I think it's important that we sort of think back to the criticisms of the movement and why certain women maybe didn't feel as involved as they maybe could have or should have.
And it actually really reflects the fractions within the feminist space more broadly, right? I think we've talked on this and this show, and by the way, I think we're screaming angry women on the podcast variety on occasion too. So I fully identify with this artistry and this art form. But we've talked on this show before about the friction when it comes to movements to end racism and movements to end sexism and the importance of intersectionality. And this is really taking that intersectional feminist lens and bringing it to the punk music scene.
Totally. Basically the same arguments that black feminists and white feminists are having today in online spaces and academia, those same arguments were happening on the mosh pit, you might say, during the Riot Girl movement. Things yes. like, yeah, I mean,
the
really.
The mosh pit. Oh my God. I forgot about that.
Have you ever been in a mosh pit?
I've not always consensually, right? Like, I've borne witness to a mosh pit. I've been on the outer ring of a mosh pit.
Oh man. I've been in a couple mosh pits. I'll never forget seeing a friend of mine break her nose taking an elbow to the face at a No Age show in a mosh pit.
Oh my God. So, you're so hardcore.
I mean, I didn't take an elbow to the nose. I saw my friend do it, which is hardcore.
Was that the end of your concert experience?
Yeah.
Or did you stick it out?
I think she was like, we have to leave right now.
I'm like gushing blood from my nose.
And I was like, wait, I want to see it. I want to stay.
Oh my God.
So really these issues of intersectionality
yeah.
were really coming to a head in the Riot Girl spaces. The same things that I think a lot of feminists still grapple with today. Things like issues of the white middle class women being elevated over those of women of color. Things of having to feeling like you have to choose between your race and your gender as opposed to having that be, you know, an intersectional framework. These are the same arguments we're having today, and they were the same arguments playing out in the Riot Girl scene.
It's fascinating to see how it applies to totally different subsets of society, of the artistic and musical variety, right? And this article by Gabby Bess in Broadly called Alternatives to Alternatives, The Black Girls Riot Ignored, really underscores the experience of being, let's say, a young black punk fan like you, Bridget, and reading these things like a 1992 Newsweek article that literally defined the movement, the Riot Girl movement, as something that was, quote, young, white, suburban and middle class, basically literally erasing black women or women who didn't fit any of those categorizations. And it just sort of confirms the explicit whiteness that was brought to the Riot Girl scene by journalists who are covering it and describing it to those who might not have been in it.
Exactly. And a line that resonated with me so much from that article: there were black women who imbibed with the spirit of punk in their bones outside the Riot Girl movement as well. These women carved out their own feminist pathways into the hardcore scene precisely because they were rendered invisible by the Riot Girl movement. And what I think jumps out at me at that quote is that because black women were marginalized both by the larger punk scene, you know, with lots of white dudes, and through the Riot Girl scene that emerged from that scene, which is mostly white women, they really were forced to carve out their own pathways for expression and kind of build these alternatives to the alternatives alternative, right? If punk is an alternative and Riot Girl is an alternative to punk, these black women had to say, okay, we're making another alternative to all those different alternatives.
It's, again, existing at the intersection of being a black woman in a space that's makes all women marginalized and then further makes women of color not feel included in that space that was carved out for women in a male-dominated space.
Exactly. There's a really famous black feminist theorist named Pat Hill Collins, and she has this great theory called the matrix of domination, which basically means that as black women or marginalized women, all of our oppression is interconnected and sort of magnified because it's interconnected. And in reading about, you know, black punk women, that just, I was thinking about that theory, like, jumping up in my head as I was reading. One of these black punk rockers who was interviewed for this article really sort of hit the nail on the head. She said, the double burden of being a black girl who has to deal with the white girls in the scene on top of being a girl who has to deal with the white boys who dominated the mosh pit at punk shows.
Right.
And so, again, you can see how it's this double bind of having to deal with the isolation from these white guys in mosh pits who are awful and having to deal with these white Riot Girls who could also be awful in their own ways, it sounds like, as well.
Yeah, and can we explore what we mean by being awful just a little bit here, too? Because it doesn't take explicit intent to be awful in this case. What we're really talking about is not being inclusive.
Right.
And that is just as awful because you're basically erasing the right of women of color, in this case, to exist in a space that doesn't even acknowledge their presence.
Exactly. One of the punk rockers interviewed in this article really talked about how, for her, this idea that a lot of female, white female riot girls had that, you know, I want to do a mosh pit where it's going to be safe, it's going to be women. She'd actually talked about how she never felt unsafe because she was a woman. She felt unsafe because she was black. And that the conversation that was going on around women in punk scenes and how they were treated totally forced her to erase her blackness, even though that's impossible. And so it's just like what you said. When I say awful, I mean just not keeping in mind inclusivity and intersectionality when you're talking about this. And then also making marginalized women feel like they should be grateful for even being included at all.
Right.
Saying, you know, oh, the fact that you were even invited into this scene, it doesn't matter if we overlook you or erase you or completely don't even speak to your issues. You should be thankful to be here at all.
Right.
And I see that writ large in the feminist movement a lot, those tensions.
Definitely. And I think that also became such an issue when Riot Girl was treated in a retrospective light more recently. So at that NYU collection, looking back at Riot Girl, I find it really fascinating to say that now with it becoming this sort of symbol that we can look back on for punk and women in punk, the fact that women of color are being left out even in retrospection is truly problematic. It doubles down on that experience of ignorance. It doubles down on that exclusion of women of color being invited to even look back on that era and look back on that movement and look back on the rise of the punk scene. And as Mimi T. Nguyen, professor of gender studies and women's studies and Asian American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign put it, quote, "With Riot Girl now becoming the subject of so much retrospection, I argue that how the critiques of women of color are narrated is important to how we remember feminisms and how we produce feminist futures. If Riot Girl fell apart because of a race riot, how is this to be remembered? As catastrophic melee? As course correction? As a brief interruption? And how then are we to face the future with certain progress having been achieved or with violence, including erasure, deferral, or annexation, not having ended?" So basically what she's saying is, looking back on this movement, how we talk about race impacts how we can all move forward in either an inclusive or not so inclusive way.
Definitely. And I struggle with this a little bit because I love a lot of these Riot Girl figures. And why I loved them is because they talked openly about things that weren't pretty and weren't great and weren't easy. They talked about sexual assault. They talked about, you know, the patriarchy. They talked about things that weren't easy. And it's I see them now, and I really wish I had seen more artists using race and conversations around race in their art in those ways. But one musician that I really want to shout out, who was really seminal in Black punk and the Riot Girl and alternative movements that sprang up for Black women, is Tamara Kalee Brown. She's an artist who has performed with bands like Fishbone, which is another seminal, mostly Black punk band, and other acts like Outkast. Shout out to them, because we're here in Atlanta. And she even was the face of the documentary about Afropunk. So if you bought that movie, that DVD, she is the woman on the cover. And she's actually talked about how, even though she is associated with the Afropunk movement now, back in the day, like in the 90s in New York City, she didn't have the benefit of an online message board for Black punks. And it was a totally isolating experience for her.
Huh.
And she writes about how sort of Riot Girl at the time just wasn't speaking to her issues. She was a Black woman living in these really intense urban environments that were infested with crime, and she didn't feel safe. And so this idea that Riot Girl for her represented this sort of safe, sanitized version of white womanhood,
right,
that just did not jive with what she was experiencing, which is being a Black woman with a shaved head, having to exist in these, you know, very tough streets and sort of live day to day. She didn't see her own experiences being reflected in the music that Riot Girl was putting out.
Right. And I love the way that she described that frustration as saying, quote, "Riot Girl felt like a bubblegum expression." You know, she's talking about having to be out in the world and just survive. I have to survive. I have to defend myself, she said. Not like her counterparts who were sort of the white punk artists in the Riot Girl scene saying things like, "You just think I can't play because I'm a girl." You know, she really described it as being a really a lack of equivalence in,
right,
in terms of the complaints that she was talking about and sort of the frustration and anger that she brought to her punk artistry versus some of what was more mainstream in the Riot Girl movement.
Totally. And I think we should talk more about Brown, her eventual contributions to the Riot Girl scene and the alternatives that sprang up after this quick break.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
And we're back, and we were just talking about how Black women, feeling isolated from the punk and Riot Girl scenes, were really forced to carve out their own spaces as an alternative to the Riot Girl scene that did not seem very inclusive to them. And what I love about this is that it starts with a party, like most good things in life. Brown met up with other rockers like Maya Glick and Honeychild Coleman, and eventually organized something called Sister Girl Riots, a series of DIY punk shows for Black women as an alternative to the punk scene that was dominated by white men and the Riot Girl scene dominated by white women. Their first show was Valentine's Day of 1997, and it sounds lit.
I just love the, like, reclaiming of the name, too. Sister Girl with a hard grr in there, too. Which is a great way to sort of highlight the sisters involved in the scene, right? Like,
yeah.
Black women in the scene. And one of the fun facts about the Sister Girl Riots is that they made space for white allyship. So they really went out of their way to be inclusive, even more so than I would say Riot Girl as a movement had been for Black women or for women of color in the punk scene. So iconic feminist punk band, sort of lead, the Slits is Ari Up, one of your favorite musicians.
I love
Bridget.
The Slits so much.
She performed as a, you know, as a white woman in the Riot Girl scene. She performed as an opener at a Sister Girl ally. So it's really interesting to see that behavior of inclusivity modeled through the Sister Girl Riots.
And so you might be thinking, why does anyone care about this? Who cares? No Black women in punk? Sure. Why is it an issue? But it's an issue because representation really does matter. If you listen to our Lisa Simpson episode, you know that it's important for people of all kinds to see themselves reflected in different spaces. And growing up, I never saw myself reflected in this scene that I loved so much and that I connected with so much. And so having these conversations now and going back and lifting up the examples of Black women in the punk scene is very, very important. And I think that someone who noted this very well is LaRonda Davis, who is the president of the Black Rock Coalition. She argues for the necessity of more representation, not just for Black women in punk, but for Black women in general. She writes, "I never looked at a magazine and thought that that was what I was supposed to look like. On the one hand, it's actually kind of liberating to not be the standard for what womanhood is. That standard put a lot of women in boxes. And they lived their lives trying to get out of that box. Black women were never even allowed in the box. Mm-hmm. I wasn't looking at a TV saying, oh, that represents me. I wasn't listening to music telling me about my experience. I had experiences that told me I wasn't concerned with these things that the happy songs were about." And so I think that quote really nails it for me. why it's so important to see yourself reflected, why representation really does matter.
In media of all kinds, including music.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think it's any episode about the history of Black women and punk would be, we'd be remiss to not mention that one of the songs that I think of as the feminist punk battle cry is actually, we have it because of a Black woman. You probably know the song. It's Oh Bondage Up Yours by the X-Ray Specs. And they had this amazing Black woman singer called polystyrene, which is a pun on sort of the plastic thing that you get your hamburgers wrapped in. And really, what I think makes this song such a feminist battle cry is the opening lines, which if you know the song, you know how it goes.
Well, which we're going to play
yeah.
for our listeners.
It's just an amazing song. It's so great. If you don't know it, you're going to love it.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think, oh, bondage up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4!
And what I love is not only the artistry that she brings to her music, but also her background, her story. They here in The Independent, they write of Polly as a dumpy, frumpy, almost willfully unsexual girl from Brixton with braces on her teeth. Polystyrene was a perfect candidate to find herself through punk. Turning this persona on its head into an art form, she became one of the movement's principal female figures. Her song, Oh Bondage Up Yours, a feminist rallying cry.
I love it so much. And even Kathleen Hannis, who is often cited as an early originator of Riot Girl, although she would probably push back against that title, she often cites Polly as a major musical influence. In Polly's obituary in the New York Times, Kathleen Hannis was quoted as saying, "Polly lit the way for me as a female singer who wanted to sing about ideas. Her lyrics influenced everyone I know who makes music." And I think that's so important when you have this person who is often cited as a seminal figure in punk, who went on to do all these really important female-led projects like La Tigre and Bikini Kill, saying, oh, if it wasn't for Polly and X-Ray Specs, these folks might not even be here.
I love it. And let's talk a little bit now about some Black women artists in the punk scene now that we should all be paying more attention to. So what artists would you recommend our listeners check
out
for more?
If you're interested in more rock music from Black ladies, there's a lot of, you're in luck. This is a great time for it. One band that I have to sort of shout out is the Alabama Shakes. Alabama Shakes is fronted by a Black woman. Their hit song, Don't Wanna Fight, won Grammys for Best Rock Song and Best Rock Performance. And when they won, it was the first time a Black woman had won or been nominated in those categories since Tracy Chapman in 1997.
That's crazy.
Yes. And shout out to Tracy Chapman because,
I know.
Speaking of formative Black women in my musical history.
I wouldn't
history,
have thought of her as punk.
Tracy Chapman?
Yeah.
She's not really punk. She's more soul, rock, soul.
R&B. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, not R&B.
Another band to check out is a feminist punk band from London called Big Joni. The lead singer of this band actually has a TEDx talk about being a Black feminist in punk, of course, called Oh Bondage Up Yours, which you should definitely check out. And you might not even think of them as punk, but two artists that I love that you should definitely check out if you've never heard of them are Beyoncé and Solange Knowles. Beyoncé used to really be thought of as, you know, just a pop musician, but with her seminal album Lemonade, she was actually nominated for a Grammy for her song Don't Hurt Yourself in the category of Best Rock Performance.
And rock performance.
Yeah, I don't think people really know this about her, but that album really was a big step in terms of her branching out and sort of people opening the door for other kinds of music to be considered rock.
That track she co-created with Jack White from the White Stripes, right? So he was at least sampled on that track, too. And he is like, the White Stripes is 100% rock and
roll. Oh, for sure, for
that
sure.
That makes a lot of sense.
I know there was a lot of noise when Beyoncé was nominated in a rock category from people who were probably super hardcore traditional rockers. But according to Recording Academy Senior Vice President Bill Frymouth, he told Metal Injection, "I think what we found this year is that so many artists that were in rock or rock adjacent were taking more sonic risks this year than ever before, and it made for a really exciting dynamic landscape in that field. That Beyonce recording has Jack White in it, and it has Led Zeppelin samples. And in it, I think it's Beyonce really stretching. It's an artist at the height of her musical powers, and it's really reaching in many different directions, and we're all better for it. And I just love that quote. It's so great.
Sonic risk. I love that. Let's all take more sonic risk.
Let's all be more like Beyonce in all the ways. And again, Beyonce isn't the only Knowles family member who's known for taking those kinds of risks. Probably my favorite album of the last 5 years is Solange Knowles' A Seat at the Table. If you haven't listened to it, turn off this podcast and put it on. It will change
Remedy
your life.
That.
But basically, she talks about how one of the seminal songs on that album was really rooted in exactly the kind of things that we're talking about. The isolation that she felt as a black woman interested in punk and alternative music. So in an interview, she explains how the song FUBU really has punk rock roots. She says, "When I think of FUBU and the album as a whole, I think of punk music and how white kids were allowed to be completely disruptive, allowed to be an anti-establishment and express rage and anger. They were allowed to have the space to do all of that, even if it meant being violent or destroying property. And that wasn't exactly inclusive to us if we created the groundwork for rock and roll. If we were inclusive and we were violent and destroying property and able to express that kind of rage, then it would not be allowed in the same way." And so even though FUBU is not a song that you might think of as traditionally punk, it really is rooted in exactly what we're talking about today. This feeling of isolation that a lot of black kids grow up feeling, looking at their white punk counterparts.
Mm. And FUBU stands for something.
For us, by us.
And it reminds me of the way that we talk about protests a little bit.
Yeah.
Like I've seen that mirrored in, oh, this was such a peaceful, nonviolent protest full of white women on the women's strike, contrary to Black Lives Matter protests that have gotten violent in the past. And it's like, well, violence is not seen as threatening all the time when it comes from a white kid setting a trash can on fire.
Right.
Whereas at a predominantly black demonstration, the same kinds of behaviors are framed really differently and seen as more threatening.
And I think that's a great example. And I've always thought, you know, threatening behavior begets threatening behavior. And so when I was at the Women's March, I didn't see things like tanks. I didn't see an oversized police presence.
Right.
And so if you go to a Black Lives Matter march or rally, the fact that those things are already there before it even starts, I think kind of becomes an indicator for what kind of climate they're already preparing for.
Mm. It's like a ratcheting up that happens.
Exactly.
On both sides. Interesting. Well, I think that's such a great point about punk, because punk is violent in its undertones, right? It's about expressions of anger and outbursts. And so creating a space for black women in particular to buck gender norms and to buck racial norms of what's expected and what's tolerated in a really angry artistry is important.
Yeah, I mean, what's more punk rock than growing up in a situation where you are dealing with microaggressions all day long? I think back to myself coming home in junior high and turning on my stereo and just rocking the F out to some, to some punk music and just getting that out at the end of the day. And I think it's important for black kids to be able to do that and have that space, the same as their white counterparts.
Yes. Cis Mindy listeners, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite way to rock out, to punk rock, or to let loose and let your sort of music expression share your frustration with the patriarchy or with injustice? How are you musically letting your punk flag fly nowadays?
So we want to hear from you, black punk fans and punk fans of all stripes. You can hit us up on Instagram at Stuff Mom Never Told You. You can tweet at us at Mom Stuff Podcast, or you can send us an email at momstuff@howstuffworks.com.
The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring. like banking.
Because Boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.